For tonight. One is that we didn't finish speech retrieval last time, and so we can do speech and then the end part music. A second part is cross-language retrieval, which is on the list for tonight. Third thing is that you will have naturally some curiosity about what it is that is due next week. And so we can spend some time talking about that, which is your batch evaluation results. A fourth thing is that Mai's got the final, what have I been up to so far presentation course. Yes? Okay. Then next week, we will do, what if it's something else? Pictures, videos, things like that. And then the week after that, you'll teach the class, and I'll sit in the back. Right. And I'll invite as many experts as I can find on the things that you're working on to come listen to your presentations and talk about that. So we can talk next week about how to structure the presentations for the week after, and also about the reports that are due for this. And also about the final exam. Anyway, there's a lot of stuff to do. We can do any of it this week, and we can do any of it next week. Except we can't talk about the images this week, because it's not this weekend. I would suggest that what we do is we do cross-language retrieval with the idea of keeping it coherent, rather than trying to pick up in the middle of where we were before, and then getting to the end of that, and then ending in the middle of cross-language retrieval. So if we have to defer something, we'll defer speech into next time. Is that okay? Okay, so before we start, questions? Do you ever have questions? Is it because everything's so clear? Okay, so let's do cross-language retrieval. So here's the problem. The World Wide Web was actually not the World Wide Web. When it was created, it was the English Wide Web, if you spoke English, or it was the Chinese Wide Web, if you spoke Chinese, because we can build search engines that are language agnostic. The original research that was done on information retrieval was dominated by the United States and the United Kingdom. So English was the language in which lots of the ideas were first worked out, and then people tried what they called multilingual retrieval, which by which they meant not English retrieval. Right? And they would find out, for example, that there were interesting things about Chinese because people didn't put boundaries between the words in written Chinese, just as in spoken English, we don't find boundaries between the words. And so we had to use similar strategies for written Chinese that we have to use for spoken English to figure out where the boundaries would be. So there was sort of that direction. But that still left you, even if you could do that, with a Chinese wide web for searching Chinese queries, Chinese documents, and you didn't find English documents. And it turned out that the people who spoke English had an advantage on the World Wide Web, because when you made a URL, you couldn't, in the early days, write Chinese characters in the URL, or Arabic characters. What you wrote was ordinary ASCII characters. And the first word in, so ASCII is an acronym, you remember from the beginning of the semester, what's the first word?
American.
American, right? So we sort of got a built-in advantage, because whatever it was you were describing, at some point you said the name of your machine, what organization it was associated with, and something about where it was in your file system. That's how URLs were built. And you said that essentially generally in English. I mean, maybe if you were French, you would say it in French, just different or something. But generally, people would say something in English. And so the web search engines learned very early that you could find web pages that weren't in English by searching the URLs. This turned out to be a really bad idea. Because, think about it. If you're a web search engine company, how do you make money? You show people advertising, right? In different ways, but that's essentially where the money comes from. Okay? So, how do you make money better than the New York Times or Time Magazine?
Targeted advertising.
What's targeted advertising, right? So you're going to show people targeted advertising. So you're going to show people with information that they want an advertisement that goes with their information. Yes? But they can't read all the foreign language stuff. You'd actually like to not retrieve the foreign language stuff for them, so that your service would have put the information together with the advertising in a way that what you're providing was useful information with targeted advertising. Instead of useless information with targeted advertising, which might be nice, but you wouldn't help keep your customers around very long. So the next thing they did was they tried to find out how to get rid of all that Chinese information that just happened to have English words in the URL. Right? So instead of saying, this is good, we found all this foreign language information that nobody can read, they said, this is bad, this is crudding up our result set from the perspective of our searcher, who after all typed in English and therefore can probably read English. Right? We don't know much about them, but we know they typed an English word, so let's, or at least the word using Western characters, so let's assume they can't do anything with this Chinese stuff, and let's get rid of it. Now, if I wanted to know if a document was written in English and I didn't know how to read, how would I go about finding that out? Dictionary, right? So I could just take the English ISO dictionary or any dictionary that you could find, any list of words in English, and I could see how many of these words appeared in the document. I do that with a whole set of languages, and I see which one hits the best, and I say, I'm going to guess it's that language. Now, it might be a document written in a language that I don't know. In which case, I'll guess a language I do know, and I'll be wrong. And so I might put some tweaks around this to, you know, make a confidence estimate. And if I say, well, it doesn't hit any of them very well, then I might guess I don't know. Right? But otherwise, this is how the search engine companies do restrict by language in their advanced search they have. Now, it turns out that the real problem is both easier than that and harder than that. So here's the sense in which it's harder than that. What if it's written in Chinese, and in Chinese there are many character sets? There's traditional Chinese, there's simplified Chinese. The traditional Chinese can be in GB 2312, something like that. What's that? What's that?
2312,
yeah. GB 2312. Or it could be in Unicode. It could still be in simplified Chinese. The traditional Chinese could be in Big Five, or it could be in several variants of Big Five. Or it could be in Unicode. So I might have different character codes that this is in. How would I detect which character code it is? Now remember, I don't even know what language it's in yet.
Anywhere?
Actually, engrams are going to get us to exactly where we want to go. but it's not the answer to this question.
Okay.
It's the answer to the next question. So do you see the problem here? I've got this trick. I use a dictionary. I look up all the words in the dictionary. I can't use the dictionary because I don't know what character code.
Trial and error. Language model.
I don't even know what character code it's in.
Right. But, you know, the word the occurs a lot in English. So let's see it. The word the in ASCII is showing this.
Ah,
the word
there we go.
In Unicode is showing.
Very good. So that's the trick. So I just take my dictionary, and I make it into a dictionary that is in ASCII, a dictionary that is in Unicode, a dictionary that is in, it's a Chinese dictionary, and it's in Big Five. It's a Chinese dictionary, and it's in GB23. Okay? Okay? There's no difference in this technique between character code and language. It doesn't know the difference, right? Finding the character code, finding the language, same problem. Yes? Okay, now let's try to simplify it. So in that sense, it's harder. It's not much harder. I just have to make my dictionary in those different character codes. Tom said he wanted a dictionary. Dictionary has like 100,000 words in it, right? Alistair said he wanted the. Can we find a middle ground? Could we like take half the words out of the dictionary and do just as well?
Sure.
Which half?
The most used.
What?
The most used.
So we're going to keep the most used half or get rid of the most used half? Keep the most used half. So we could remove the least used half and it wouldn't affect us at all.
Well, somebody's writing a biology paper.
Even then, they probably say the.
They probably say
the. How many words do I have to keep? Let's start at the other end. Instead of how many did I get rid of, how many do I have to keep?
100.
There you go. I need a stop word list. If I have a stop word list, I cover an awful lot of the occurrences. So in any running sequence of text, I'll hit the stop word list a lot if I guess the right language in the right coding, and otherwise I'll miss it. Yes? But that's actually a bit of a problem for queries. Because as I type in my query, I'll get a word and then another word, and that's about it, right? And the average length of a query on the web is somewhere around 2 words. A lot of one-word queries. And searchers go out of their way not to type in stop words. So this technique's not going to work for queries. But it's going to work brilliantly for documents. Right? And we could ask questions, how short can my document be and have it still work? And the answer would be pretty darn short. You know, once it's got 50 or 60 words in it, it's going to have a whole bunch of stop words and we've got a lot to work with. Right? But for queries, it's not going to work. So I need a better idea for queries. Now, what's the better idea?
Ngrams.
What did you mean by ngrams? There's only one word.
Well, you take the query and you use ngrams to search through your document and it matches.
So you're saying... You're saying I'm going to take character engrams, yes. Not sequences of words, sequences of characters.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to take character engrams, mm-hmm. And what am I going to do with them? What do I do? So my query is hippopotamus, and I take 5 grams, and so my first 5 gram is hippo, mm-hmm. And my last one is potamus or something, and all the ones in between, right? Now what do I do?
Search your corpus looking for a match on those characters. That's the best way to describe it, I guess.
So I search my corpus and I know the language of my corpus, so my...
No.
So how am I going to do a character? Help me out here. We're close.
I need a dictionary. Search your
dictionary.
My dictionary?
With the
ingram. Or with it. Okay. That might work. But now I need the whole dictionary again, right?
Right.
And still, it's a little iffy. What was wrong with the search the corpus idea? Why don't I just take the Wall Street Journal in the moon? Right? And what I'll do is I'll just take all the 5 grams I can find and
in the whole print run of the Wall Street Journal,
yeah.
I'll get pretty good 5-gram statistics for English. The whole print run of Le Monde, yeah. I'll get pretty good 5 grams for French.
Sure won't be that many.
I don't even need to pick unique 5 grams. I can just count up how often I see this, and then if I see some pattern, I can say, well, you know, which one does it look more like?
Yeah.
It'll work. Works brilliantly. So character and grams, not for the dictionary, but the full statistics of the language, allows us to get so short we can do a single word. Not with high accuracy, but with much better than random. We can guess what language. And if we see several queries in a row from you, and we make the assumption you're using a consistent language, we get it pretty fast. Unfortunately, all of this was developed in the United States, where people only speak one language. And so simply getting rid of all the rest of the world's languages was a big improvement. Right? Because after all, most of the information on the web was originally in English, since it was originally developed in Switzerland. Anyway, it was, but the Americans took it over very quickly. So now we've got the ability to reject things that are in languages different from the query, but now enter Europe into this. So Europe has a very easy time with the web because the character set works for them reasonably well, except for all the accents and stuff. We can deal with the accents much more easily than we can deal with multi-byte characters. So now the Europeans are doing this, and the Europeans have a different problem. They know several languages, and they want to find all the information they can read in languages they can read, so they'd like to tell the system, here I know this language, and here's my query, and only say the query once. So they want to find many result sets off one query. Yes? So that's where the problem starts to become interesting. And then enter again the Americans, who say, oh, well, maybe they're saying something interesting in all those languages, particularly if it's Chinese or Arabic. And so maybe we could have clueless Americans searching Chinese and Arabic and trying to understand what those people are saying. And so you land up with, for essentially security reasons, people in the U.S. thinking how cool it would be to be able to search other people's stuff and get the answer back in English. So now we've ratcheted it up a step further, right? Now, the story goes one step further, and that is people in places where nobody's creating information. So I speak some language that most of the information in the world isn't written in, let's say Bengali. An awful lot of people speak Bengali, but nobody's creating mass quantities of information in Bengali. So it's a narrow information market with a large number of consumers. What's the problem? Well, the reason no information is being created in Bengali is they don't have a lot of money to spend. So now I've got lots of people who could use it. And what they want is they want to be able to find information and read it, just like the Americans, except they want the Americans to pay for it. So what we're going to do is we're going to get the Americans to come up with ways of reading Arabic and Chinese. And then we're going to play a bait and switch. And we're just going to pretend that Arabic and Chinese are English and that English is Bengali. Right? We'll just flip the whole thing on its side. And we will have created a way for people around the world to read what's going on in English where there's an awful lot of information. Okay? So you see that there are four markets here. There's the I speak English, I want to search English, and I want to get rid of everything else market. That was where we started. The second market is I speak three languages, but I don't want to ask my question three times. The third market is I speak only English, but I want to search everything in the world. And then the fourth market is I speak only Bengali, but I want to search everything in the world. Right? Those are the four markets we have to serve tonight. And it looks just like all those other problems. We just hold the elephant's nose until it looks like English, and then search it. Right? So we just take whatever it is that's out there, we run it through some kind of converter until we have English. It doesn't even have to be very good English. We'll just count the words and search it. right? So that's what we're going to do. There are some pretty pictures from several years ago. This is 2004 data. And in 2004, only 31% of the users of the internet were first language speakers of English. So many people speak English as a second language, particularly many users of the internet. But only 31% of the people had it as their first language, and hence, presumably, as their preferred query language. But at that time, 68% of the web pages were in English. There are two reasons why this happened. One is that at every time there's been some language of commerce, right? Latin, German, today English. So English has a capture effect. English attracts people to learn English because there's so much information in English, which then results in the creation of more information in English. So it's likely that there will always be a disproportionate amount of information in English, and hence this sort of mismatch that causes the search to be search technology to need to cross language. The second problem is this is counting the wrong thing. I mean, remember what pays for web search in the first place? Advertising. Who do you want to advertise to? People that have money. So you shouldn't be counting the number of people. If you want to understand what this looks like from a search engine's perspective, you should count the number of dollars. And if you do that, this is wildly out of whack, right? Because the people who speak English as the first language dominate the world's web. Whether that's right or wrong, if you're a web search engine company interested in making money, you want to serve the English market really well before you worry about anything else. And then you want to think about, okay, how much money is there to be made by showing Chinese to people who speak English? And the answer is, it's a relatively small amount of money compared with the English market. So you got to get the English stuff right, and then you can fight around the edges for this. Which is why you don't see this stuff in web search engines. Now, if you look at this, so this plot is web users. This is not population of the planet. These are users of the web. So this is the well-connected population of the planet, right? This is old data from 2003. This is even older data. This is 1999. But if you look at how many people speak this language, you find an awful lot of people speak Chinese. Not many as a second language. You find that an awful lot of people speak English, and then a remarkable number of people speak either Hindi or Urdu, which I'm told is the same language written in different ways. The linguistics here is not true. Okay.
And I don't even agree that Hindi is less than Bengali. It should be other way.
Okay. And the question was in 1999, should it have been that way? Anyway. So there are a number of languages in which there's not a lot of money, including Arabic, that you wouldn't invest in for commercial reasons, but you might well invest in for social reasons. And the question there is these are extremely sensitive to the price. So probably the investments in Japanese are not terribly price sensitive. Right? If you make a product, there's a market. But in a number of places, there's a tremendous sensitivity to the price. This is what I was referring to earlier on global trade weight, and this is really old data, so now I think China's moved up even further. Actually, no, it's probably about the same place now. But in any case, the numbers are all higher. But this gives you an idea of where the money is, and essentially the languages down to about here are all pretty well supported. And then everything off the far end doesn't get much investment. Now, what we're going to talk about tonight is a set of core technologies that can be used in several ways. So you can use it in retrospective search, what we normally think of as search. You can use it in the real-time problem of filtering stuff as it's coming in. Actually, you could do a lot for my email just by removing all the Chinese. Or you could use these sorts of things to support real-time interaction. For all of those things, it would be sufficient if we could find a way to take ideas expressed in one language and re-express them in another language for one of two users. Either for people who would then understand and be able to make use, and in a chat would be able to reply, or for machines who would be able to do something simpler, maybe just find things. And the key to this, the thing that people didn't appreciate when we started, is how very different these are. So you can do this brilliantly well, even while you're doing this terribly. So people call this problem machine translation. And they call this problem cross-language information retrieval, at least in the IR context. And they're radically different problems that work on the same underlying technology. But this problem, if you get the words right, but you get the order wrong, people are somewhere between laughing and misunderstanding. But for this problem, if you get the words right and you get the order wrong, we're fine. Right? So you can make a lot, in fact, if you get half the words wrong, we'll probably still do something for you here. But if you get half the words wrong here, you were out of business a long time ago. So this is a really easy problem. And the insight here was the people who were working on machine translation, which is a really hard problem, ultimately came to realize that what they needed was a really tolerant user, because there was no way they were going to get all the way there very quickly. And so they came up with a concept of good uses from EMT, good uses for Kermit machine translation. And we were sitting there at the right time, in the actual truth, to solve their problem and be a user for their technology. Okay, so essentially the problem we're going to have to solve is, how do we do this well, and how do we accommodate the fact that we do that bad? Because we have the human in our loop a lot. Right? And we're going to have to find some way to account for the fact that humans have a lot of trouble with this. Okay. The distinctions here start to get really arcane. Because, for example, everybody called this multilingual information retrieval for a while. And then we realized we had lots of different kinds of multilingual problems. So we had a multilingual collection. It's got German and French in it, and we got a search engine. We had a multilingual document. It's got German, and it quotes somebody in French. We got a search engine. We have to find it. Right? We might have a multilingual system. It could take a German query and find German stuff, or a French query and find French stuff. It's multilingual, in some sense. It works in many languages. And so all of these things existed before this community developed. And so a bunch of people who didn't really understand English very well decided that this should be called cross-language information retrieval. Anybody who knows like what an adjective is would have called it cross-lingual information retrieval. But none of us actually knew what an adjective was. So it landed up being called cross-language information retrieval. And in that problem, we take in the query in one language, we find documents in another. And that's sort of a simplified version of the real problem, where the query might be in one language, you want documents in many. And then, because everybody wants to invent terminology, somebody else came up with another term so that if it can take queries in any language and find documents in any language, we'll call it a translingual. It doesn't really care about language. And to make a translingual system, it would suffice to have lots of little cross-language systems. And in fact, the research questions all come around here. The funny story about how this community started. The late 1970s, 1978, the United Nations came up with a standard for multilingual thesaurus. And this is actually how you would solve the problem if you were in a thesaurus-based search world. You'd simply take the thesaurus and translate it into the other language, and then people who knew that language could search. And of course, the thesaurus isn't really in any language, it's just a set of concept descriptors, right? So there are all sorts of technical problems when you do that. Like, if I have a good English thesaurus, can I just translate all the terms into German? That's not really the best way to do it. If I have an English and a German thesaurus on the same topic, can I merge them? Even worse in the first way. Or should I build them from scratch, knowing which languages I'm going to have? And so people made up standards. And in 1964, a group started working on this. In 1978, ISO took it over from the United Nations. And in 1985, everybody stopped working on the problem. The problem has been pretty well worked out. The answer is you should keep in mind the languages you're going to be using, the domain you're going to be using. You should make the thesaurus with the languages in mind. This is an ISO standard published in 1985. And people stopped doing research on this. Now, then what happened was a group at a spinoff from Bell Labs called Bellcorp came up with an idea for accommodating synonyms. So if I had two words that meant the same thing, I could use those two words together with a single code. And the way they did this, we talked about a couple of weeks ago, for a latent semantic index. Right? Remember at least the discussion of latent semantic indexing, what it was for. It was for folding together synonyms based on the usage pattern across documents, right? So they came up with a really clever idea. So they invented that idea at Bellcorp. And it was first published in 1987. And then by 1990, a couple of Bellcorp researchers realized that translation is simply synonymy across languages. So they said, I got a synonym finding machine. You got a problem of synonymy. Why don't I apply my synonym finding machine to the synonym? So I'll show you later how that works. It turns out there's one really elegant trick that makes it work. But the sort of historical sociology of this is these people had never heard of this problem. In fact, they didn't even care about searching across languages. What they cared about was they had latent semantic indexing. It was a hammer. Which nails can it be used for? So this was an interesting technical problem. They knew of a piece of research that had been done at Cornell University in 1970. And so they cited that. And that had been done by a well-known researcher, Jerry Sultan, the best-known IR researcher in the U.S. at the time. And they had been trying to figure out how to search, you won't be surprised by this, Russian using English. At the same time, the Russians had been trying to figure out how to search English using Russian. And so there was sort of an arms race in the late 1960s. And the Russians published first in 1968 or something, and then Sultan published in 1970. And so Sultan essentially took the vector space model, for which he was well known. So the Europeans were doing something different at the time, and the vector space model was popularized by Sultan in the US. So he took the vector space model, and he said, how about we just look up the words in a dictionary and see how well the thing works? And the answer was, it didn't work very well, because this was 1970, and the dictionary was pretty small, and everything was pretty small. And it was kind of a cute little toy experiment, and they were done. But this work was known by the thesaurus-based community, because it was done in that period. And it was also known by these folks, because it was done by Sultan, who was well known in their field. There's not another single point of confluence between these two literatures. They're two completely disparate literatures that happen to both cite one piece of work that they had in common. And these people were citing it saying, you know, this is weird that nobody did it anymore, essentially. Okay, so that's where it all came from. We only have to solve three problems in order to be able to do cross-language retrieval. First problem is, what should I translate? Now, I have two possibilities. I could translate the documents into the query language, in which case I held the elephant's nose until the term flowed out to search it. Or I can change the queries into the document language and just pick a different elephant. Right? So, which one should I translate? Can you guess what the answer is? What's that? Wrong. Both. Okay. You make different mistakes. You should translate them both. Okay. The second is, where do I get my translation knowledge? And there are two obvious possibilities. One of them is really obvious. I can look it up in a dictionary, a bilingual dictionary. But one you might not have thought about is I can look it up in many examples of translations. This is the Rosetta Stone, right? If I had a Rosetta Stone, I could use it. So if I happen to want to go between like Demotic Greek and hieroglyphics, where are we at? We got a Rosetta Stone. Okay. Anybody want to guess what the answer is here? Well, you're getting the idea. Okay. Yeah.
Where would people who are familiar with the language come into it?
So there are really four places where you can get them. And so people are a third. Right? So at just the right time, you can go running across and find the right person who might be sitting in front of your assistant as a user. Yes? Okay. So that so people are a third. And there's actually a fourth. Anybody want to try to guess the fourth? So when I listen to students from China talking about their work at the university, I can understand about every tenth word they say. You know, they're going, whoa, 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 quiz, whoa, 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 computer, whoa, 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 you know, algorithm, right? So English words get picked up in lots of languages, right? When I go to a party with these same students, I don't understand a single word they say. So technical vocabulary tends to get picked up with a similar pronunciation. The French won't use computer. They have to say ordinateur or something, you know. But that's because French has to be French. But in general, there's a lot of this sharing, and the sharing is based on similar pronunciation, one way or another. So you can get similar writing styles across languages, but that's just because they're reflecting similar pronunciations. Or between Arabic and English, or between Chinese and English, there's actually books in Chinese about, you know, if you meet somebody and their name is George Bush, and you want to write it down, what should you write? Right? Well, there's no word for George, so, you know, what do I do now? There's a word for Bush, but, I mean, it's not polite to call him Shirley. Okay. So I have to find, you know, George A. Bush or something like that, and find some combination of Chinese characters that if somebody says it, he might recognize he's just been referred to. Right? So there's this idea of transliteration. Of loan words. Yeah? Or property. Okay, so that's the fourth one. Okay, and then here's the one everybody missed. So everybody thought about this one and they all knew that the answer was queries. Well, like you guys who ultimately figured out the answer was ball. And the answer ultimately turned out to be ball. Then they tried this one, and the answer turned out to be yes, ball, and two more. And then they tried this one only because they ran out of other things interesting to work on, and it turned out that this one was way more important than either of these. Right? So, if I told you what the translations were for every word in your query, and for every word in the document, what would you do with it? Because, I mean, think about it, there's not one translation. If I have a word, that word has many meanings. The meanings each have several translations, because there are many words in the other language that mean each one of these things. And besides that, there's not really any concept of exact synonyms anyhow. I mean, we might have a word in English that sort of carries a shade of meaning to it. But in Chinese, the word might not have that shade of meaning. You might have to put several words around it if you want to convey that shade of meaning. And sometimes we don't even have a word. We have to translate it to a phrase. Okay. So how we put all that together turns out to be where the really interesting stuff is. Okay. If you could do that, you would still have another problem. Because we've trained an entire generation of searchers to communicate with dead authors. Remember back in the beginning of the semester, the idea that there are a lot of authors out there and you have to kind of learn their lingo, right? So you have to probe the collection, try a few things, learn from what you read. You're ultimately learning how they wrote, right? So they didn't choose words to make themselves findable. They chose words to convey an idea, but then you have to choose the words they chose to convey their idea if you want to define them, right? So we've created a set of searchers who know how to communicate with the past through a search system, in some sense. Now think about what we're about to do. We're about to create a new kind of searcher. And they don't communicate with the document collection anymore because, remember our assumption, they don't know the document language. So what do they do if they don't know the document? They can't, like, learn which words are people using in Chinese for this concept. I mean, how would they even write them down? So they're instead communicating with the system. But that doesn't mean they don't have to learn how to communicate with the system. It just means you design the system, and then their problem is to communicate. And then the system has to figure out how to communicate with them. Did you see how this isn't going to work nearly as well? Because we're removing the user from the direct contact with the collection. So essentially what has to happen is we have to build two parts of our system. And in most of the technical work on this, people think of this as if this is the same thing, but what's really happening is the system has to guess what the hell you mean, and then the system has to do the right thing for what it thinks you mean. And you have to guess, how is it interpreting what I'm saying? So you can say something that will interpret correctly. And we spend all our time trying to get this part right. But if you get this part wrong, right, if the user is in a bad loop here, it is diverging rather than converging, right? Then this part won't have a chance to work. And so here, the key idea is we have to tell the user, here's what I think you just said. So that the user can say, I didn't think that at all, and correct it. So there's a loop here that's really important, and then there's a loop here that's really important. And they sort of depend on different capabilities. Clear what the decomposition of the problem is? So, engineers always do this. I have this big complicated problem. How am I going to solve it? Well, I'll just draw lots of little boxes. I'll draw arrows between the boxes. We'll label all the boxes. And then it's somebody else's problem to make the boxes. I solve the problem. If you could build these boxes, this problem would be solved. Right? So here's the solution to the problem. I got a whole bunch of junk out here. I don't know what language is. So I'll build a language identification box. Now I know what language is. Okay? So that problem's solved. We don't have to worry about it anymore. It might not be perfect, but we're worried about that. As I described it already, it's pretty close. Okay. Now look, it's either going to be Chinese or English in this simplified diagram, which if you just have 100 of these. So let's just say it turns out to be Chinese. Well, then I got to find the Chinese terms on the document, but that's okay. I know it's Chinese. If I was searching Chinese ever, I could probably do this. Okay, then if I had a Chinese query, I could just search it. Right? Just in the usual way. Because it's Chinese, my query's in Chinese, so I'll pick some, you know, you give me a query, how many colors are there in the rainbow? I'll take out how many are and make it into colors rainbow. So that's what this box does. Pretty trivial box in most search engines, just passes everything through. And then search it. And I'll get some rank list of score documents, right? Document 1 is 0.72, and document 2 is not scored. Right? With me? Okay, now if it turns out to be English, then I need my cross-language search box. And now that I've got my cross-language search box, I can take my Chinese query, my English terms, I get a ranked list of English documents, and document 3 is better than 4, which is better than 5. Now, if these are in the same space, so that 0.91 is better than 0.72, which is better than 0.57, which is better than 0.48, which is better than 0.36, I just sort them and I'm done. Right? So, the purpose of this is to point out that we have now simplified the entire problem down to the problem of making this class. Right? I can do any complex problem you can give me if I can build that class. Yes? So we'll just talk about this box and figure the rest of it out if you work with it. So we talked about how to find out what language it's in. These are the character n-grams. These were the words. And of course, you could have just looked at the HTML and it would have told you what language it's in. That's one of the things people put on web pages see this. Usually incorrect, but at least there. If you don't know anything else, you can start with that. It's often incorrect because people use web page editors. The web page editor defaults to calling it English, and then they proceed to write in Spanish. The web page editor has no way of knowing that they actually wrote Spanish. And if somebody lies, you can hold it in Spanish. You've got to be a little careful about the language. Okay. Now, four block diagrams. If I want to do what we call document translation now, you've got to be a little bit careful about this. We don't actually have to translate the documents. In fact, we usually wouldn't want to translate the documents. We usually want to make vectors of the documents and translate the vectors. But that's probably not even the right thing to do. So instead of getting the technology confused, this is what people call document translation for cross-language IR. But the system here doesn't actually have to do translation. It could do something simpler than that. So we could refer to it to be consistent as query language IR. And we're going to do the retrieval in the query language. We just take the documents in a simple version, translate them, we build a retrieval engine, we get the query in English, the document's already in English, we get the results. Now, if all my users were going to issue queries in English, how many indexes would I have to build for all languages in the world? One. Let's say I tried this system and all my users were going to ask questions in their native language, of which there are only 2,000. How many indexes would I have to build? 2,000. This would be a very bad idea. Yes? Now, almost every paper you read on cross-language IR uses the other approach. I can show you the other approach. So here, we translate the query. We take the translated query. We use it to search the Chinese documents directly. We get back the Chinese documents, and we provide them to the searcher as the results with a translation step. I have to translate the documents anyway to show them to the user. So I may as well have translated them back when I did my search, which I could do with a slow translation system and just whenever it finishes, I'll index it. Rather than now, where the user's going to hear one, but they where's my translation? Okay. So this is a query translation architecture which does the search in a document language. Which of these do you think would be easier for the user to understand?
First one.
Why?
Because when you translate the query, there is a chance that what they're looking for is lost in translation.
And you have no way to explain to them that it's been lost.
Right.
Whereas at least they know if you've got a lousy translation of the document, they look at it and say, hey, that's a lousy translation. Maybe I can't search this so well. The user has a better mental model of what's going on with document translation. So why is it that all the research is done with query translation? So what happens is, let's say I want to explore different translation systems. I don't have to re-index it every time I change the translation system. Right? So there's a lot of research done in this paradigm, but it's not necessarily the paradigm you want. So query translation works really well if the queries are short. But of course, if you do more like this searching, the queries are long. And the query translation systems become less responsive. Query translation is also hard because if I don't know which translation to use, I can't look at the words around this word in a query, because there might not be any words around this word in the query. Whereas in a document, I could look at the words around it. The document translation has an advantage that there's additional context. And of course, document translation only needs to be done once. But if I translate English into Chinese, or Chinese into English, if that's my choice, which one would you expect to work better?
Chinese
to English. Why?
Because Chinese, it's like the Latin, they have many words which probably won't exist in English.
It wasn't clear to me why that made it easier. So Chinese has many words,
it's more complex than English.
Okay.
So
I'm simplifying. Do you know Chinese? Who knows Chinese? Which way is better?
You mean that it's better for the user to understand?
No, I mean which one's more accurate? If I want to translate English into Chinese, the first thing I have to figure out is where the words are. In English, how hard is it to figure out where the words are? Pretty easy compared to Chinese, right? In Chinese, I'm looking at this thing and I'm like, maybe that's a word, right? If I get the word boundaries wrong, everything else will fail. And in English, the word boundaries are handed to me on a silver platter. Yes? In Chinese, whoop, anybody's game. Okay? Now, that says if I want to translate out of a language, I want to translate out of one that has really good word boundaries, right? Yeah. If I want to translate into a language to do retrieval, which language do I want to do retrieval in? English? What's that? What's a desirable characteristic for a language in which I do retrieval? Every word has only one way of being expressed, and it has no synonyms, right? There's no variation in expression. Every word has one meaning, right? As we know, English lacks this characteristic, right? English is very messy. How about Chinese? Every word has just one meaning in Chinese? No. So neither one's preferred. Which language has more morphology? English? Chinese?
Only the native speaker can tell you those words. Like, if I say for Hindi, it's as complex and it has as good morphology as English.
How much morphology is there in Chinese? Not morphology like ed and ing and that sort of thing? Hardly any, right? In Chinese. So I love matching in Chinese. Boy, if somebody told me where the word boundaries were in Chinese, it would be great fun. I don't need a stammer. Yes? Okay, so I want to match in Chinese, and I want to translate out of English. English gives me the word boundaries. Chinese gives me the simpler morphology. Indeed, when we do cross-language IR experiments, we set the monolingual performance as a baseline. In Chinese, the monolingual performance is degraded by the fact that we're getting the word segmentation wrong. But we're given that in English. So you can actually get better cross-language search in Chinese. You can do better search of Chinese using English queries than you can using Chinese queries. Someone should patent that. Tell Baidu.com about this. Just teach everybody to issue English queries. It will work so much better. Okay. So, big point. Point we did not understand when we started this. It makes a difference which way you're going, and you make different mistakes depending on which way you translate. And so, if you can translate in both directions, then you can get twice as many mistakes. But anything that is consistent between, if I translate in one direction, it says these 10 documents. If I translate in another direction, it says those 10 documents. And these three documents are common, they belong up at the top. So this is really stupid. If you were enamored of these ideas, instead of translating in both directions and adding them and dividing by two, you could take your Chinese query and translate it into French. You could take your English query and translate it into French, and you could match it in French. That would be really stupid, right? Yes?
I don't know.
But you'd guess?
Probably.
I can convince you this would be really stupid. So, this is what's done by latent semantic indexing. Except it's not French now. You take your Chinese and you convert it into vector nonsense. You take your English, you convert it into vector nonsense, and you match in vector nonsense space. Right, remember I told you before, you just take the English query, you convert it into vector nonsense. You take the English document, you convert it into vector nonsense. So the only trick I have to tell you is how to do cross-language latent semantic indexing. But it's done in vector nonsense space, right? The directions don't mean words anymore. Because we did all those dimensionality reduction tricks.
So you have to map the dimensions?
Yeah, so it has to be the same dimensions for both. I have to build a common vector space that has English and Chinese.
Yeah.
But if I can solve that problem, so here's how I do it. We'll do English and Spanish, right? It's actually what they did on the first try. Actually, they did English and French. English and Spanish is what I did. So, let's say I have document one, and it's got English word one four times, English word three two times, Spanish word one twice, and Spanish word four once. Okay. So what we did was we took an English document collection, and for every English document, we appended its Spanish version. We just made Spanglish documents, English and Spanish together. Not by having a document in which people flip back and forth between languages, you wouldn't find very many of those in the world. We just took the English documents, we hired them, they translated them into Spanish, we got them translated into Spanish, we just crammed them onto the end of the English document and said, here, go. So, you see what happens is, I see English word four twice as many times as I see English word three. And I see Spanish word one twice as many times as Spanish word four. From this I say, hey, the vectors of these, if Spanish word four was English word three, and English word one was Spanish word two, those would be kind of reasonable synonyms, right? Okay. And then here's another 8-4-4-2. My God, it looks like a cooked example. It is a cooked example. Right? This doesn't come from reality. But you get the idea, right? So I'm learning similar usage patterns. Yes?
Is this the same as what Belcour is doing?
This is what Belcour did.
Okay.
This is cross-language latent semantic indexing.
Okay.
Yes? So now I take this, I do a dimensionality reduction, I get a matrix, which I can fold things into using linear algebra, and get representations in vector nonsense space that either come from English. I simply take the vector of English terms, add a bunch of zeros for Spanish, and fold it in, or come from Spanish. I just take synonyms using this technique and map them to the same point in the space. Yes? Got the idea? Now, here's the key insight. There's no dictionary. All we did was get somebody to give us translations, and then we made a machine that learned to make the appropriate translations. In this case, it translates into vector nonsense phase. But we could equally well take the same ideas, and we could learn to go directly from Spanish to English. So here's how they do it. Anybody ever see a minor bird? What do minor birds do? They repeat what you say, right? You say something, they repeat it, right? So we're going to get a translating minor bird. You will say something, and it's translation. Something else, and it's translation. And then you'll say something without its translation, and the minor bird will repeat it in Spanish. Yes? All we need is a system that can learn from examples, and instead of generating the English back, it will generate the Spanish that would have been said. You're wondering how we're going to do this, right?
Just draw a box.
What's that?
Just draw a box.
Let's just draw a box and call it. That's a good idea. So we'll skip all this. What's that?
Well, that's in the song.
That was one of the things we had to tell. Okay, so here's how we built the translating minor bird. Anybody recognize the cell? It's a Rosetta Stone. It was dug up by Napoleon's troops in Egypt and carted off to France, which doesn't really explain why it's in the British Museum. Anybody know the story of that? Anyway, it's in the British Museum. You can go see it. And it turns out, this was a massive intellectual effort to decode hieroglyphics. And the way they decoded hieroglyphics is that Greek is about the same today as it was back then. Right? Actually, in that time, Greek was very similar to the way it was back then. They changed Greek a little bit. But at that time, the Greek that the people spoke was not unlike the Greek that was carved on the Rosetta Stone. So you can have people come along and read this, and they tell you what happened in Greek. And they had all these hieroglyphics in Egypt, and they had no idea what the hieroglyphics meant. And they, you know, there were all these theories of whether how hieroglyphics was an alphabetic writing system or whatever. And so it turned out that what was handy here was that whatever it was they did when they made hieroglyphics, they did it in the same order. They started on the left and went to the right. And so, whatever it was that was first on this hieroglyphic stone, which is missing, unfortunately, was first here too. Whatever was last there too. And the stuff in between was pretty much in the same order, not quite. And then you could look at this and say, well, if you're into, like, word puzzles, you could just try saying, you know, can we substitute this for that? And eventually they figured out it's a syllabic language, and these things represent syllables. They got it about right. In fact, they got it to the point where they could actually pronounce the hieroglyphics. Okay? So, that was the original idea. So all we really need is a Rosetta Stone. Okay? Rosetta Stones are really only useful if you want to go to three languages, but we can go get lots of Rosetta Stones. So, for example, the government of Hong Kong is in the business of producing Rosetta Stones for us because they have other laws in English and other laws in Chinese. So, there's a Rosetta Stone. Right? But we just have to spend a few decades sorting that out. The European Union, they make a Rosetta Stone like none you've ever seen before, right? You want to do Dutch to Danish? Sure, everything's in Dutch and Danish. Right? So we can get, you know, all the proceedings of the European Parliament in any language you like. We'll just get all these things and we'll line them up. Now, if I give you a document in English and a translation of that document in, let's say, German, you could assume that the first sentence in English was equal to the first sentence in German, in meaning. And the last sentences are equal to the last sentences and all the ones in between. But you'd run into a little bit of a problem because there might be fewer sentences on one side than the other. So sometimes people split sentences or put sentences together, but in general the sentences are in the right order and they line up pretty well. So I have a length pattern in English that would say, ooh, we're going to create a long sentence, and then a short sentence, and then a sentence like this, and then a couple of really short sentences, and then a long one, and then a short one. And in German, you might have a length pattern that says, I got this, then a longer one, and a couple of really short ones, and then a longer one. And you'd say, oh, I see what's happened. This has become this. This has become these two things somehow. This would become this, these are that, 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 right? That would be a reasonable assumption, just on the length patterns. And then you'd say, eh, I don't really know what to do there, so I didn't care what it fit in the first place. Let's throw it away. Right? Yeah, look, I'm just going to count the words when we're done. I don't really care if I miss the introduction. So these length patterns allow us to, with very high confidence, say that sentence and that sentence are the same. You know, maybe the Germans use more words for something, or less words, because they come them all together. But they do it consistently. French is longer than English by a certain amount, German shorter than English by a certain amount. In Chinese, there are certain length patterns with respect to English. Right? If I have a lot to say, it takes me a long time, no matter what I say. So the length patterns work really well. And we've reduced the problem again. I used to have to learn from translations of documents, but now all I have to do is learn from translations of sentences. I can forget about the documents. I can just assume I have sentences. Yes? With me? Okay. So, this is real data. So we can say in English it says diverging opinions about planned tax reform, and in German it says something unpronounced. English, German, English, German. And then you can just sit up here, and this is not too hard, right? You can, I don't know, zur is probably a vowel, right? That's a short word, that's a short word. This word's probably this one. That's probably that one. That's probably this one. I don't know. Tax reform is probably, you know, that looks pretty good, right? It's got a reform in it. Right? I mean, you can sit here, you can be wrong some of the time. But we're not going to just do this with those sentences. We're going to do all the million sentences. If that's not enough, we'll do a billion sentences, right? And then we'll see. Geplanten seems to match to opinions an awful lot. I mean, forget about how do you draw the line. 99% of the words with geplanten have opinions. I mean, it's probably not true here, but, you know, German. But if it were true, you'd say, okay, but geplanten's opinions, you know, 99%. Right? Just based on the co-occurrence of the sentences. Then you say, gee, look, I see these things flip consistently. The loop is doesn't. Right, so I could learn reordering rules. Okay, so we're pretty clear how that works, right? So if you do that, you get something like this. So this is actually automatically learned data up here, and this is something I drew that everybody keeps copying. So I know Spanish well enough to know that that's not perfect, but we'll give it a try. So you get the idea. You draw these things, and you just have a machine learn to draw them based on how often it sees sentences with both of those things together, and it's how often it sees consistent kinds of reorderings. Okay. Now if I do that, then I get this. If you pardon the machine here, these are supposed to be Chinese-looking characters. Right? And they're the same. So probability of this Chinese times the difference. Probability of this Chinese word being the correct translation survey is 0.4. Probability of some other Chinese word being the correct translation survey is 0.3, 0.25, 0.05, and, you know, it's got to add up to 1, right? I mean, there is some translation, and if we look at enough text, we'll probably see it. So you see where we get these numbers from? Yes? Know what happened here? I haven't seen a dictionary yet. These are wrong. They're learned from usage patterns. They're roughly correct, except that the probability that some Chinese word is the correct translation for survey is 0.001, because I saw it 1 in a billion times, right? Well, that's probably wrong. So there's some point at which I'd have to cut this off if I really wanted it to be right. a Chinese speaker would look at this, if they could see the Chinese characters, and at some point, as they went down the list, they'd start laughing. Right? I mean, the probability "the" is the correct translation for survey is something bigger than zero. Not much bigger than zero. So we want to find a way to cut it off. But this is pretty good. We just made a dictionary, except this is a really good dictionary, because it tells us the probability that the translation is.
This is better. Let's just try to figure out why you're doing this in addition to the vector space model. The vector space model. Really,
oh, you mean that latent semantic index
yeah.
foolishness?
That's not really a dictionary.
Because it didn't know which words translated to which words, it treated documents as the unit.
Okay.
And here I've got the sentence now as the context. And it mapped everything to nonsense vector space, which I have trouble explaining to people.
Yeah.
But this maps things to words in the other language.
Okay. I thought you could use the nonsense vector space as a dictionary.
You could, it's an extra step.
Okay.
Okay.
But this is better.
Well, this is what everybody uses.
Okay.
Because this is sentence scale with word reordering, whereas the other one's just document scale. This one has more information available to us. So I get really very good probability estimates, particularly if I want to search the European Parliament collection. Because if I want to search the European Parliament collection, what I do is I learn a translation model from one part of the European Parliament, and then I search the other part of the European Parliament, and look how well it works. Because it's learned not only how English and French are related, it learned how they talk in the European Parliament. So when they use this word, 97% of the time they mean that. Which may not be true in general English and French, but it's certainly true in the Parliament because I'm looking at the data. It is true in the data. Yes? If you measure how well you're doing, and you measure how well you're doing on a problem you don't need to solve, because remember, you already have the translation to the European Parliament data, your results may look very good, you may get promoted, you may even get tenure, but you will not get rich. All right? So you have to train on the European Parliament and go test on news stories, which is why everybody loves the Hong Kong laws. Because surely we're not trying to retrieve the Hong Kong laws. We're trying to retrieve something else that's in Chinese. So that's a kind of a fair setup. So you want to find one of those fair setups and ask how well does that work. And for that, you can be sure the probabilities will be wrong compared with your actual application, simply because words are used in different ways in your application, but you don't know by how much. So your best guess is whatever it is I learned over here. Unless you happen to have a dictionary. Because if I happen to have a dictionary, it will tell me what things are reasonable choices, and I can say, well, what I learned over here, that's certainly how it looks like in the Parliament. And what I learned over here, that's certainly how it looks like if I know nothing. So maybe halfway in between the two is what I would know if I started with the dictionary and shaded it in the direction of the Parliament. So the idea is that the people in the Parliament must be talking about ordinary things much of the time. You know, revise and extend probably shows up a little more often there, in a certain sense, than in ordinary use. But many things probably show up there with their ordinary usage, particularly things like the law. Okay. Anyway, once we have that, then people started screwing it up. Because let's say that I knew that the probability that this word should be translated into that word was so much. Then here's what I would do. I build my vector in English. Well, let's say I build my vector in Chinese if I want to translate it into English. And then I take the vector and I multiply it by the translation probability matrix. And I get a vector in the other language. We'd be done. Yes? So when you see the matrix, right? I've got all the terms in English, all the terms in Chinese. Other translation probabilities, they sum to one in the appropriate direction. They can't sum to one in both directions, it turns out, but just set it up so they sum to one in one of the two directions. I take a vector in English, I multiply it by the matrix, I get a vector in the other language. If you're big on linear algebra, trust me, it works. Yes? That fails. It actually gets you part of the way there. But it's the wrong thing to do. And here's why. What's in the vector? TF, IDF,
weight or a length, put together somehow your favorite formula, the M25 or whatever it is. Yes? It's a weight, right? So I'm actually not converting counts. Mm-hmm. I'm converting weights. Yes?
Yeah.
Now, let's say that I have a really rare word, right? And this really rare word has a really uncommon translation. So it's an uncommon word and an uncommon translation. For example, the Chinese word for monkey. It's not rare. I gotta find a rare word. The Chinese word for cataclysmic event meaning the end of the earth. Let's hope it's rare, right? Maybe there's no word for that at all. If it has a rare translation for that rare word into the, it's not often translated as the, right? Then what happens? Well, it's a really rare word, so it has a really high IDF, which then gets multiplied by the really low probability to get to be a pretty normal word. So what I find out is your query for the end of the earth just got translated as the, and you will find all the documents with the in it and return them as describing the end of the earth. Yes? So the problem is that when we did IDF, remember, if it only appears in one document, that's a big deal. If it appears in two documents, not quite such a big deal. 20 documents or 21 documents doesn't really make any difference. It kind of flattens out. It's that non-linearity that we're applying it in the wrong language. We applied it in Chinese. We said, this is a really rare word. It's like, yeah, but what we meant was the searcher asked a really rare word, which we now found. It's the searcher's really rare word. Right? But the searcher didn't ask that. The searcher asked the, which we will now match. So we want to do this on the other side. We don't want to compute BM25 and then map it, because our IDF statistics are not statistics about the query. They're statistics about the document language. We want our terms to be valued based on whether the user has asked a very selective question or not. Right? We're trying to compare between the query terms. Here's how we do it. This took a little while to figure out. So this was figured out in Finland in 1998, and they didn't know why. They just knew that it worked. And what they figured out was that in fact, let me show you what they figured out in 1998, because it was a good trick. So this was the trick. They said, I've got a query term, and I want to know the IDF I should use for this query term. And that means I need to know how many documents this query term appears in, right? So if the query is in English and the document is in Chinese, how many documents does the English query term appear in? None. The document's in Chinese. Right? Yes? So that wasn't really the question. The question was, if the document had been in English, how many times would this query term have appeared in the collection? Right? That's the real question. So here's how you estimate it. You say, well, I know these four translations from my dictionary. What if one of the... I really get into it. What if one of the translations was right and the other one's wrong? I'll just assume I don't know which one's right, and I'll say, well, this document couldn't have occurred any more, or this query term couldn't have appeared any more times than all of its translations put together. I'll say, if that one occurred in four documents and this one occurred in 10 documents,
and the other two occurred in zero documents, the answer is 14. It's not really 14. It couldn't be higher than 10, unless the two things are synonyms. But I'll just say, whatever document this thing occurred in, any translation of this occurred in, is how often this document, this term occurred. I'm going to try that one more time. I want to know how many documents this term occurred in. So I'll ask how many documents does the do translations of this term occur in, and that would be my answer. That protects you against your rare query terms. Well, get a real generic. Let's take a 10-minute break, and when we come back, I will draw you a picture. Yep. Okay. What's that?
I might be tired. I understand the formula. Okay.
I should be able to we have to
set it. It grows as you
Yeah,
the event is today. Yeah, but I would view it like zero. There is mostly in the cockpit area of the site.
So you have the initial database or?
Yeah, I have the initial database, but the Dharma CD.
Updated?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I'll just check.
Hopefully, they'll be excited about it as well.
Okay.
Those people might have learned something.
And so you can now imagine the news query, Titanic, Antarctica, which never would have appeared previously as a query, right? But now it's a query of the sort you're likely to get. Now, I have an imagined language, which we'll call C for Chinese. So Titanic has two translations. Translation C1, which means Titanico or something. You know, it's a phonetic transliteration of the name Titanic. And it appears only 7 times in recent news stories. Actually, it appears 10 times. 3 of them are with this other translation in the same document. This term C2, which means the, but is also learned by our system as being a translation for Titanic, it appears 40,000. Right? So the appears a lot, so you know we're not surprised by that. Right? But we have a mistaken translation here, or a not very helpful translation anyway. And so what will happen is this translation of Titanic will be treated as very rare, but this is very common. And so this will distort the statistics. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to say, well, Titanic, surely this is the right translation, but this is the wrong translation. And if I get it wrong, I pay a big price. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just treat this as 40,010 times I've seen Titanic in my collection, in one of the two translations. Over here in Antarctica, I see this word 3 times, I see this word 7 times, I see them both together once. You know, I just have two synonyms, they both mean Antarctica. So I say, okay, look, this is a really common, this is a really rare word. This is a possibly common word. I don't know. Right? But possibly common. So if I don't know which translation to use for these two things, I darn well better give Antarctica more weight than I give Titanic, because otherwise I'm just going to grab all this stuff. So the way that that's done is I say, well, look, for Titanic, how many documents does it appear in? And the answer is, well, it appears in however many times C1 appears, and it appears in how many times C2 appears, add them up, and remove the duplicates. So I take the set union, the set of documents with this, the set of documents with that, the set of documents with either of them, and I'll take that as the number of documents that contain Titanic. Then if I want to know what's going on for Antarctica, I'll do that again over here for Antarctica. Okay? Now, for the term frequencies, I just sum the term frequencies. I say, well, look, I see some document, it's got Antarctica with C3 once, and it's got Antarctica with C4 once, so it's got Antarctica twice in that document. Right? So I'm taking the term frequencies, this is the insight here, taking the term frequencies and I'm mapping them across to the other language. I'm taking the document frequencies, I'm mapping them across to the other language, and then I'm computing the BM25 in the other language. Y'all are still looking at me like I'm talking Greek here. I can do hieroglyphics.
Can you explain how you get them across the language?
Yes. So I have a matrix, and if it's coming out of a dictionary, the matrix has ones and zeros.
Okay.
One means it's an allowable translation, zero means it's not, according to the dictionary.
Okay.
I have a vector of term frequencies. So I say I observe these term frequencies. If the documents have been written in the other language, which term frequencies would I have observed?
I'm sorry.
I do document frequency because it's what I drew on the board. I'm going to do this separately for term frequency and document frequency. So here's my translation matrix. I've got term Chinese 1, Chinese 2, Chinese 3, Chinese 4. I've got two English words, Titanic and Antarctica.
Okay. Okay, so it's the C term.
Right. So I can observe in the collection term frequencies, but not for Titanic or Antarctica. Neither one of them ever appears in the collection because it's a Chinese collection. But what I can observe is the C's. Right? Okay. So let's do the DF computation. It's more interesting of the two. So I can say, let's see, Titanic is, well, that's my translation matrix, right? And now if I have a set of documents. We just take one document. So I have one document, D3, let's say, I think it's D46, just to make it clear that some documents in the middle. And it has one copy of C1 and one copy of C2. And no copies of C3 and no copies of C4. Okay? Now I want to ask what's the term frequency in this, the term frequency first, sorry, in this document of Titanic. How many times does Titanic occur in this document? You would say twice. Yes? Once is C1 and once is C2, but how do I know the difference, right? All I know is I looked it up in the dictionary and it said counted, you know, said you got one of each. They could both be Titanic. You don't have any probabilities. Do the best you can. Add them up. Okay? Now, what's the contribution of this document to the document frequency for Titanic? Does this document have Titanic in it?
Yes.
Yes. Does it have Antarctica in it?
No.
Okay, fine. If I do this for all the documents, I will find that only 11 of the documents have Antarctica in it. And if I do this for all the documents, I will find that 40,010 documents have Titanic in it. And so I will say, wow, Titanic's really not a very useful search term. Why? Because it's dangerous as hell. I might think it's rare when it's common, or common when it's rare. I don't know what's going on here. But the only way that this number could be small for document frequency is if all the translations are rare.
Right.
So essentially what I'm doing is I'm cranking down the weight on any translations that are dangerous. And I'm leaving the weight cranked up, the IDF really high, only if I'm sure that there's no translation that is common for this work. So I'm protecting against that. And then we can run experiments and find out if this is a good idea, and it is. It's a brilliant idea. This idea alone raises the percentage of monolingual performance from 50% to 80%. Because it protects against mistakes. So it misses some things, but it avoids getting misled and latching onto the wrong thing. Okay?
Yeah.
And as the queries get longer, the effect of this stuff getting thrown out decreases. Because with longer queries, there's a better chance somebody would have put a synonym in that had a safe set of translations in the dictionary. Yes? With me now on the idea?
You don't really have a dictionary.
Well, if I had a dictionary, if I was given a dictionary. So now what we do is we just say, well, look, I don't have a dictionary, but I got a probability. Well, so look, 0.999, 0.001. 0.5, 0.5, right? I learned something like this from my Rosetta Stones, which we call parallel text, the translation error. So I learned something like that. Now what do I do? Well, you have to run a bunch of experiments to prove to yourself this is the right thing to do. But what you do is you do exactly the same multiplication. And now I've got 1 × 0.99 plus 1 × 0.001, add them up, 1. Mm-hmm. So I've got this document occurring, or this, I've got Titanic occurring once, which is a much better estimate than twice. Right?
Yeah.
And I've got a contribution of this document to Titanic having occurred in a collection of one. So now I can get partial document frequencies.
Okay.
Partial.
You can look at the probability of the document.
Well, these probabilities are arranged here,
yeah,
and it's estimates of the document frequency. But essentially I'm saying, if they just had the common courtesy to write this darn thing in English, how many of them would have occurred, would have contained Titanic? Yes? That turns out to get you from 80% to 99%. So think about this now. I wanted to make a ranked list. We don't really say that, right? We said we were doing a retrieval. What I really meant was I want to sort the documents, but they're Chinese documents, based on an English query. So I'm going to walk to some part of the vector space, and I'm going to pick it up, and I just have to get to the right part of the vector space to pick it up. Right? Except, it's a Chinese vector space, and you're going to tell me in English what you want. And so I have to use the English to guess where in the Chinese to walk to. That's essentially what's happening, right? It's a way of thinking about it. This produces a ranked list of documents in Chinese. Now think about how a ranked list works. Think about why a ranked list is so good. Because the document most worth looking at, based on however well the system does, is going to be on top. And the second best document's furthest down, and the user can decide where to stop looking, right? That's the assumption. Except these documents are in Chinese. How's the user going to know where to stop looking? I mean, what a user would reasonably do here is they would take the documents and send them to a translation bureau and pay to have them translated, the best ones. Okay, great. That means I better tell you where to stop, right? Because otherwise, you don't know if you should have done the next one or not. And you sure can't wait until the first one comes back a week later from the translation bureau before you decide whether to send them the next one. Now, the translation bureau is not ever going to be able to get back to you in 2 seconds if it's being done by a person. Right? So we have a system that is perfect. I mean, 99%. Except that it doesn't. What it does isn't what the user needs done. Because if the user can't recognize the good documents and decide which ones to send off for translation, we should have been giving the user a set and said, here, pay for these to get translated. Rank retrieval is the wrong thing to do. You want to do Boolean retrieval. Using a thesaurus, so right back in 1985. The entire setup of the problem is wrong. But the entire first half of this class, solving the wrong problem. Because we made a rank list. And how are people going to use the rank list? Okay. So this is where we got to in about 2000.
Why couldn't you just cut off the rank list at a certain number?
Well, you could, except that the ranking doesn't tell you what number to cut it off at. You need some other thing that tells you that. I mean, you could cut it off at 1, that would be very principled, but you might not find what you're looking for. You could cut it off at 50, but that might have not have been the best place. You might have been able to save money and cut it off something like that. So I'd like to have the rank list and a way to tell you where it's going.
An optimized
place to stop. Or,
it's not arbitrary.
Or, I'd like you to be able to decide where to stop by showing you a translation of the Chinese that was made for free on the web. By all the visitors, right? And so if you can read a lousy translation well enough to tell if your document's on topic, then we did the right thing after all. But now this is not a question of do you like the translation or are you happy or did you understand it? This is, can you tell if it's on topic? So now the question is, can you decide whether to pay for a translation? How would you answer this question? It should be really obvious by now.
Yes.
What would you do? You guess?
I'd use it with a lousy translation.
And you'd be done, right?
Mm-hmm.
You'd just say, let's hope. How would you measure whether or not users can do this? You do a user study, right? You give them a rank list. It's too obvious. You give them a rank list of poorly translated documents. You run a cross-language IRS system, produce a rank list, translate all the documents automatically, give them to the users, and say, please mark the ones you pay to have translated. And then, for every time they get it right, you give them a cookie, and for every time they get it wrong, you slap them on the hand, or the equivalent precision recall F-measure thing, right? And you just measure how accurately users can do this.
Don't the users naturally assume that you're just running an English query against the query translation in the feature system?
Oh, yeah. They don't like the system. And what you find is that people are really good at this test. So we ran the experiment. And people are quite good, remarkably good. Now, what does it mean to be remarkably good? People disagree about whether the same document is on topic when they both know the language. Now you have somebody who doesn't know the language, who's disagreeing with, presumably, somebody who does know the language and produce the ground truth. But what gave them the right to make this decision, right? Since people in the same language system. So all we mean when we say that we can do this well is that people can agree across language as well as they agree within language, not that they agree perfectly. Yeah? And so we have a real fuzzy sort of a measurement. How well do people agree across language? And the question is, how close can you approximate that? And the answer is very close. Okay, well then that means that we solved the right problem. But now, think about the second problem. Did I ever tell you about the drive-by shooting? There's a library in Venice, California, that in between two one-way streets. One of the streets goes to the beach. The other street is going home from the beach. And the library is directly in between. And so this was sort of my perfect analog to Trek-style IR evaluation, is a drive-by shooting. You're driving along, going towards the beach. And along the way, you think to yourself, I'd like a few books on such and such a subject. As you pass the library, you shout out to the librarian, Titanic and Erica, or whatever, your query, your two words. The library's got nothing except your two words. You're at the beach all day, huh? And on the way back, you slow down as you go back to the library. the back one, huh? But these books come sorted into your back seat. And then, when you get home, start at the top of the list. Read the books until you find what you wanted. And how happy you are is how many books you have to read, right? Before you got it. Now, nobody does drive-by shootings, except at that particular library, when they've got a query. They ask the query, they see the results, they change their query. But now think about the problem. I just showed you that I can have a really good rec list, and you can use the rec list reasonably well. Except now, you want to change your query. Well, you can't do that very well because you don't know what this document's about. And if you do learn a word from the document, and you type the word in, the word might get translated differently than had actually been behind there, because translation this direction, translation that direction, not the same, right? So now we have to run another user study. Or now we say, okay, fine. You can make as many queries as you like. The first time, you couldn't make any queries at all. And the system gave it to you and said, here, put a check in the box if you like it. But now, we're going to give you a real live search engine, right? Which will eventually grow to have the name Miracle, because it's a miracle the damn thing works. Right? So, the Maryland Interactive Advanced Cross Language Engine, that's a miracle. We've got a competition. So now you've got this miracle system, and you're going to type in your query, get back a bunch of documents, change your query based on what you see in the lousy translation of the documents. And we're going to see if you can make things better or worse. And if you can make them better, if you can make them much better. Because we know you can make them much better in an ordinary situation. And what we found out was that people actually develop different strategies for doing this than they do in monolingual search. So all the user studies that you do are how well does my user do in the first 15 minutes after they see my system, right? That's when you start measuring. Somebody has 5 minutes to turn into the user study, but everybody else had 15. But the real question is, how do they do after, 10 years of experience at this? If we ever build a system, after a while, people have a lot of experience. The question is, does it work? So we watched people do this over an extended period. And we found out they came up with all sorts of interesting strategies. For example, we had one where we had them looking for things on the Iranian nuclear program, and our system kept mistranslating it as Iran nuclear file. And they're like, okay, if that's what it wants to call it, that's what I'll search for. And they found all kinds of stuff once they started searching for the Iran nuclear file. Right? Even though that'd be a nonsensical thing to ask for, but once they knew the error characteristics. Another thing we saw was that we had a word the system didn't know how to translate, and this was in Spanish. And so it just put the word up in Spanish, left it untranslated. And so the people typed the word in. Kept coming up in documents they liked, they tried it. And the system didn't know how to translate it. So it left it alone. And it matched beautifully. And if we'd been smart, we would have put a little thing in here that said, don't translate this. But we didn't, and they just got lucky. So we learned we had to build in a don't translate this button. So there are all sorts of new strategies that users come up with for doing this. And so if you do a bunch of user studies, it turns out they do pretty well. And so then you start thinking, hey, can we go back to the original idea? Can we get the user to help us translate?
Who are the users in this game?
So they're university students because they're so darn accessible. So that's a really good question, and in good user studies, you should use professional searchers. We claimed that we were using librarians because they were representative of professional searchers, and we were interested in serving professional searchers. But that's a pretty weak claim. So this is what you're trying to avoid. Oh, here's a real translation, by the way. Can you tell? This is a translation from a system that was built in 29 days, from a standing start. Hmm. Can you tell what it's about?
word for a palm blast.
So, and this story came out about the time of the nightclub bombings in the Valley, so you'd have a bias in favor of that. You would have heard about it in other contexts. And of course, the real translation didn't have the nicely highlighted section. So here's a system that we actually built. Now, we built this system in 29 days from a standing start. It's built to do Hindi, so it does Hindi English. And Hindi turns out to be really nasty because in English, they had ASCII and EBCDIC. They were kind of like VHS and Beta, and ASCII 1 and EBCDIC went out of fashion. In Chinese, they had traditional and simplified, and they're still arguing about it. But at least they have two. In Hindi, every publisher's got their own character code. And the character code only works with their font. So you get a commercial advantage by getting people to download your font because then they can read stuff from your service. So it's sort of anti-standardized. And so the first thing you have to do if you want to process a lot of collections or a complex collection is you have to be able to read a lot of fonts and do exactly what they're trying to keep you from doing and convert them all into one standard. So there is a standard, the Indian Standard Code for Information Exchange, or ISTE, except it's honored in the breach, not in the use as a standard. So in any case, we took 2 weeks to figure out how to convert all this stuff into ISTE. And then we went looking around for all the Indian translated texts that were from Hindi into English, and we found all sorts of stuff, but nothing from news. And so we wanted to know, how do people translate Hindi into English for news? So what we did was we started a competition where we said, make the best translation. If you can make the best translation, you will get a free prize, Amazon.com gift certificate. And so we had people around the world who could display Hindi and type English, and they would compete with each other to type in the best English translation. Our system would score them based on a few English translations we had. So we'd give everybody, you know, one thing we knew the translation of and 10 things we didn't. See who did the best on the one we knew. Take theirs, add them to those known to be the best, and automatically ship off the gift certificate in the middle of the night. We did this for 7 days, and we got the world's largest collection of Hindi English news stories through viral marketing, everybody telling their friends, you know, join this new game. It turned out this was not really such a good idea, not because it didn't work, it worked brilliantly, but because this amounts, in the opinion of the lawyers, to employing foreign nationals who do not have the right to work in the United States. We thought it was tricking foreign nationals into working, but apparently that's thought of as paying people to work. So in any case, nobody does. But it was a really cool idea.
Better to ask for forgiveness and permission?
Yep. So this is a little summary of the first document. This is a little summary of the second document. This is a little summary of the third document. And over here, or up here, we have the query that was typed by the user. So this is a very effusive user has typed out Indian film and social and cultural impact. So this is your Bollywood query. They've taken this word film, and they've selected it, so it's a little off the screen here, but you can see you've got Indian, film, social, so on and so forth. And in film, it's broken out into all of these alternatives, which are duplicated over here. And I'll just pick on this one here. Here's the transliteration. Now, those who know Hindi will know this is a really lousy transliteration, but we only had 29 days, and it sounds about right. So this transliteration is cinema. Now, you know, film has many meanings, right? It can be a little membrane on the surface of the water, or it can be, you know, something you see in a motion picture show. So which one is this? Cinema? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the people who spoke Hindi, they met the people who spoke English. It's a long story, but probably they got a word for it, right? Okay. So we're going to guess that's what it is. How about this one? Chimera, I don't know. What's that?
Camera.
Hey, that's pretty good. I wouldn't get that. Okay, can you do this one?
Jahalahale?
No, it's getting harder, right? Okay, so we're not going to get everything out of transliteration. What's that?
He was asking what type means I've written the thing is used for.
Well, it turns out that the translation of film is this word, according to the probabilities we have, with this probability, which is about the same as this probability, so it's not so bad. And so this is learned from the statistics in the parallel text. And the translations of that term back into English are periodontitis, lining, membrane, and film. It sounds like a trip to the dentist.
Right? Actually, you might have got it right, but it should have been jolly. You don't have to, it has like too many.
Yeah, it's poorly transliterated. Okay, so we have some kind of a film or a membrane inside your mouth or something here, right? Not really what we had in mind for this context. So an astute user will look at this and will say, here's a definition of that word, which we just reversed the translations and listed them. Right? And they'll say, we can deselect this word. It'll just lead us astray. Yes? Now, do you see what's going on here? We're communicating between the user and the system about what the system is doing. So we're putting the user in control for managing the iterations. Not having to guess what's going on inside the system. We're actually showing the user what's going on inside the system. And then we can measure how much better they do with the user study. Yes? Anybody want to guess how much better they do? None at all. They get better at some, worse at others. They have an equal ability to improve things and disprove things. It's because they remove words that they didn't know were the right translation, but that turned out to be the right translation. None of this stuff's perfect. We have a way of going and finding examples of usage, but none of it's perfect. So it's not a good reason to show people this. But their ability to understand it means they get the same results in fewer iterations. Because they don't have to have this sort of hunting peck probing to see what the machine's doing. If they want to screw it up, we let them screw it up quickly. If they want to improve it, we let them improve it quickly. And if we gave them more time, they might learn how to use it more effectively.
Did you study that?
We didn't study giving them more time. Okay, now, let's see. I don't think I have in here the final results. Okay. So all of that is going to leave you with one remaining question if you were a search engine company. Let me just bring up the end of the story. And that is, can people really do this? You show me all the parts. I believe all your user studies and stuff. But can anybody actually do anything with this? I mean, all you did was say, find me documents, right? Find me documents that are relevant. That was the task in every one of these. And finding relevant documents isn't the user task. It's the thing the user does so they can do their task. So in order to convince the search engine companies that they really ought to do this, we ran one final study. So here's the final study. We did this in 2004. We found 8 users who didn't know any Spanish. This was easy because we did the experiment in the United States. We had them search only Spanish documents. We had 16 questions that were available only in English. These were selected from a set of questions that were being used to test machines in automatic question answering. The machines were able to find 1 out of every 3 questions they found an answer for that was correct. Fully automatic. They read the documents, they guessed that here's the question, why is the earth round, and you know, here's some document that has the answer, and they pull the answer out. Okay. The machines were allowed to answer the question in Spanish, and they get credit, and they got 1/3 of them right. The humans had to actually write the answer on a piece of paper in English. Remember, the documents are only Spanish. We selected the questions to be questions the people would not know the answer to. So, for example, we got questions like, on what day was Pearl Harbor attacked? And we said, that's going to be a little easy for the Americans. Let's get that one out. And we got questions like, when did Lenin die? And we're like, well, in the first place, half the people aren't going to know which Lenin is meant by the context, right? Or by the spelling. So we figured that one would be okay. We tried 2 variants of our system. These are the accuracies. So user 6 had an accuracy of 75%. Remember, there were 8 questions. No, 16 questions. So they got 75% of the 8 that we gave them with system 1 and 75% of the 8 that we gave them with system 2. That was user 6, user 1 liked system 2 better, user 7 liked system 1 better. There's not much difference. And so we were comparing 2 systems, and our conclusion was they're both about equally good. But now remember where the machines were. The machines were sitting down here at 33%. And these are all way above 33%. And you look at this and you're like, well, these are way above. You're looking at this and you're like, hey, wait a minute. We've got all these people making machines that are supposed to do this thing automatically. Why? People are doing it pretty well. We limited the people to 5 minutes and they only took an average of 3. So we looked at how well we're doing, not by user, not by system, but by question across both systems. So it turns out that on question 8, 11, 13, every single answer, every single user found the answer. So those are easy questions. And on question 5, not many people found the answer. So these are the hard questions, and these are the easy questions. And so now this starts to be interesting. On average, we're doing twice as well as the systems. So what kinds of questions can we answer? So the easiest question is at the top. Who's the managing director of the International Monetary Fund? You know, so you type in managing director, international, monetary, and fund. And these are all words that a system will know how to translate. Any document that has all those words in it and has a name that a person can recognize, they can just guess that must be it. Right? That's pretty easy. This is a little harder when the attack on the St. Michel Underground station in Paris occurred. And here's our really hard question, when did Lenin die? Right? Now it turns out that when did Lenin die was also a hard question for machines. Because this was only in 1 Spanish document. And that Spanish document did not say Lenin died on and give the date. Actually, you don't see many news stories that say that. What it said was, last Thursday, the 50th anniversary of Lenin's death, was the blah, 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 blah. And 3 users got this right. So there are some of the users. So these are all about 8. 3 users got it right. They found the 1 document. They found the last Thursday. They computed last Thursday. And 1 of the 3 users screwed up the computation and was off by a day. No machine got it right, right? even though for the machines they would have gotten full credit for last Thursday, which the user wouldn't have gotten full credit for.
And so we've got a system in which lousy translation is good enough for search, lousy translation is good enough for recognizing things, lousy translation is good enough for understanding what the machine does, and lousy translation is good enough for one actual end-to-end task to find an answer to this question. I mean, you know, look at the things we were about. Who committed the attack on the terrorist attack on the Tokyo Underground? Did very well on that. When did Latvia gain independence? I mean, these aren't things that people knew when they started, and they were able to answer the questions. So, what's the take-home message? In the first place, we tried to solve the wrong problem. Make a rank list of things you can't read. After we solved the wrong problem, everybody who wasn't working on it pointed out to us this was the wrong problem. In the meantime, we were merely charging away trying to solve the wrong problem. So then we had to prove that this was the right problem, or refocus our research efforts on solving what would have been the right problem. And that required user studies, and the user studies had to unroll this question into several sub-questions. Can people recognize it so it's a rankless reasonable? Can people control the system? Can people tell us and explain what the system's doing? Can people come up with strategies? Does it affect people's performance? If I design my interface one way or against another way, does this affect the utility of the system? And in the end, the question, would anybody want to use this for anything anyhow? So as you think about your projects, you've got some part of that path, probably near the beginning, that you're working on. And when I encouraged you to do both a batch evaluation and a user study, it was with the idea that the batch evaluation will probably measure the wrong thing very well, and that in your problem there's probably some aspect of it that only the user study can see. And just thinking about that question is a helpful thing to do. The second thing is, you're going to wind up in wherever you go after this, having somebody show up on your doorstep and say, we're able to solve this particular problem for you, whether it's indexing oral histories, whether it's building an expertise location system, or being able to search a corporate intranet, Google Books, whatever it is. And you should be able to ask them, and they're going to tell you what it is they know how to do well. And they'll show you a check result or something. And you'll remember the drive-by shooting and the library in Venice. And you'll ask them, well, okay, so how will people use this? Now, what is there built into the system that will allow people to make sense of what the machine's doing? Because we've removed the user from direct contact with the collection. And here in cross-language retrieval, we see that very clearly. But it's happening in each one of these things that we do. We're removing the user from contact with the collection. You'll see next time when we do images, our abstraction of the collection has no words in it. So what does the user learn to make their search better? So you need to learn to critically listen to the marketing pitch and ask yourself the question, where are they in the process of building systems that can be used to solve problems? And so this path of watching one field move through is a useful way of saying, you know, oh, we know this, but this isn't really what we need to know. We need to know that now that we know this. Questions? No questions. We start to see this stuff being adopted now. There is some adoption in Europe where there are multilingual users. When I started in this, I didn't think that market would develop because I thought that at best we'd be half as good as a within language search, but we're not. We're just equally as good, very close to equally as good. We're indistinguishably good. And so cross language searchers can indeed use this. But people who are what the Europeans call polyglot, people who speak many languages.
there's naturally interest in this for law enforcement applications, for intelligence applications, for situations in which there is a paucity of translation expertise available. So this is a part of the problem that you don't need to turn to help for. You'll need to turn to help for lots of other things, interpreting nuance and things like that. But for finding it, you could have lots of people looking and filtering the information they find back to a small number of people with the right language expertise. So you can imagine somebody playing a game more like the way soccer is played than football, where they reorganize their organization depending on the language du jour. You know, one person's back here receiving, everybody else is up here blocking. And you shift it around. So that sort of market exists already, but it's a very specialized market. Multinational companies are a natural target market because they need to follow their mentions of their products in different languages, and the products will be referred to in different ways. So you can imagine very highly tuned systems like this, high-tuned filtering side profiles for competitive intelligence. And so there are some startups that are looking at that sort of problem. In general, there is a period when there is a lot of research activity and technology gets a lot of discussion. And then there's a quiet period where people are trying to commercialize it. And during that time, it's not to their advantage to talk about what their plans are. And then there's a market introduction where people make claims for it that are unsubstantiated. And then there's a market failure and a reintroduction. It's sort of a standard thing. And we're sort of in that first lull right now. So Google, for example, 5 years ago, hired a team of the best machine translation researchers in the world. Because if you're Google and you looked at this, you'd see the market and you'd say, well, let's see what we can build. But if you go to Google today, you're not going to go doing cross-language searches. You can translate the results, but you don't have cross-language search yet. Why? Probably because they don't have enough confidence in their translation of the results to see the size of the market, or maybe because they can't imagine what the advertising revenue model looks like to support this. But the decisions here now are business side decisions, the technical problems are solved. I mean, that's not to say there's not a remaining technical problem or two to work on. So here's a slide I made several years ago. In which what I was trying to do was I was trying to say, well, you know, there are some things that people have paid attention to, and there's some attention that needs to be paid to that thing, and we're sort of in balance. We understand the term selection issues in Chinese and in German and in English and in French and Arabic. Term selection, we made appropriate investment in, yeah, appropriate investment in dictionaries. At the time, there's been a lot of investment in parallel corpora. There's probably not much more to get out of parallel corpora. This was the sentence scale alignment. This is the document scale alignment. So that's a problem that at the time looks researchable. It turns out my own estimate of where the opportunities are has gone down to be more in line with where the investment has been. The reason is that what you can observe in comparable corpora, so these are the entire document scale, two people writing about the same thing, but maybe not translating each sentence, just stories on the same topic. The problem is you can learn common words and you can't learn rare words. Because rare words, you don't have enough evidence. So you need an enormous amount of data to be able to learn rare words from this, compared with parallel corpora. So I think that's a little further down now. At the time, transliteration hadn't gotten much work, but people have done a lot of work on it now, so the investment's gone up. Where people have spent most of their money, this is really funny, is in figuring out, if I know all these possible translations, which one should I use? And this was just completely the wrong question. The real question was, if I knew all these translations, how should I use that knowledge? That's not the same as which one should I use. And that's where eventually the weighted document frequency, weighted term frequency, answered this question.
And then, at the time, this was several years ago, there had been almost no investment in user interaction. That was where all the questions lay. And it turned out that in the half decade since I made this slide, this is an advocacy slide, there was very little investment in this, proportionally to the investment that continued in all the other things. And you look at that, you can either look at that as rational or irrational. So the irrational version is it's where the investment was required, but people didn't really understand how to do it. We were a community that knew how to measure things in a batch mode, and we had to learn it this way. You can also claim that it's irrational because it's extremely expensive to do user studies. You're probably finding this out now. And these extremely expensive user studies give very little insight compared with the batch evaluations. Give a lot of numbers on these things. You can analyze them in a lot of different ways. And so the ultimate user study is you form a company. And either goes bankrupt or it makes a bunch of money, right? And so it's not that people don't do user studies. It's that in the end, what you're trying to do is inform judgment. And if you can inform judgment with batch mode evaluation, maybe your judgment is enough to get you to whether or not you want to make an investment in this and put the money up front and develop a set of users and find out if real users do, because all user studies have artificialities. So the question is, since should we do so many user studies that they realize the potential, the question is, at what point have you done enough user studies that you can make a decision about going to the next step, trying to bring something to market? Also, if you look at the places in information retrieval where there's money to be made outside the web, so the web's a natural application for this, you would find things like medicine, law, patents, and nothing else. A lot of money in medicine, a lot of money in law, a lot of money in patents, and maybe there's some money in desktop search or something, but it's way down there compared to the money in business. Then if you look at the languages that dominate law and medicine, the law problem is a within-language problem. There's not a lot of cross-language law searching. It's not like the Supreme Court sits around and says, well, I wonder what they do in Latvia when they get this. I mean, they do that, but every time they do, they really piss off the Congress, right? So there's not a lot of cross-language law searching. So then you look at medicine, but so much of medicine is in English, right? And so then you look at patents, and there's a good market for this in patents, right? Because I mean, what I really want to do is I want to be sitting around, you know, in Cleveland saying, well, you know, we make widgets, and I wonder what they're doing in Japan. Maybe I'll learn Japanese. You know, probably not going to happen. So instead, you're going to sit around Cleveland and say, I wonder what they're doing in Japan. You type in your kind of widget into the search engine, and I'll come all the Japanese patents. The appropriate patent-tuned translations. You know, that know the different sections of patents that have been to be handled. So, indeed, in Japan, there is a large research project aimed at exactly that. Except that they're not trying to help the people in Cleveland. They're trying to help the people in Japan say, I wonder what they're doing in Cleveland. So that's probably the commercial market that you'll see developed first. Other than books. And web search is just, you know, one day the light's going to go on and everybody's going to do it. There are some companies that do it now, the add-ons, but they don't have a business. Okay, so remind me what we've kept for this time. We've got what's going to happen, what's due next week, right? It's probably high on your list, but there was one other thing?
Yeah, project brief.
Yeah,
how our presentations should be structured.
Your presentation, good. Okay, so we'll do the project briefs next time, and we'll do the final time. But what to do for your batch evaluation. So the way in which a batch evaluation should be done, and I haven't written this down yet, I really should have. And you'll see this if you pick up any Trek paper or any SIG-IR paper, and that's what it'll say when I write it down. Pick up any Trek paper or SIG-IR. But you have to describe the problem you're solving. You don't have to describe that in very much detail because I know the problem you're solving. But you should at least remind me of the problem you're solving. So we'll think of that as a paragraph.
Then you should describe the design of your evaluation. So we wanted to measure mean average precision. We used seven documents, or seven topics. We used the 4,000 documents. We got the queries from here. I mean, you know, it's not the results, but everything right up until the time you then did the study. That should include the evaluation measures that you're going to use. So it's all the evaluation design. That you could do in a page, but you probably want to. So you're not trying to be personalized. Then you're going to want to present the results. Usually, this is done using a combination of either a table or a graph and some words to describe it. Right? Because usually there's some details like the difference between this and that is statistically significant or not statistically significant. Or this is a mean over only 8 of the 9 topics because one of them had 0 results or something. You don't want to try to get all of that into your caption or into the figure. And whether you use a table or graphs, I don't care. Whether you use one table or many tables doesn't make any difference to you. And again, if you pick up cigar papers, you'll see this. There's a preference in the community for for tables that report 4 digits after the decimal point, which you know is silly if you've studied mathematics. Let's say the number of digits after the decimal point should reflect your confidence. No, if you did that, everyone would have only 1 digit. Anyway, you want to present the results are fine, but I'd suggest that you make your life simple and think about how do you want to show it in your final presentation and just present it that way in which you write. Just think of this as the place where you develop the slides you're going to show, all right, and start to get the story straight. All we're really trying to do is take your final presentation and split it over 3 parts so that you don't have to do everything in the last 15 minutes. So just do something for next week, then you'll have that part nailed down. Then you can think about what you're going to do with your slides and you can think about what your full story is. Right? So it's just spread out a little bit. Then, this is the part that you can sort of get verbal diarrhea on, the analysis of your results. What do you have to say? I can give you a clue that it would be really good if you had something interesting to say. Right? I can also tell you that after you said the 18th interesting thing, you won't get any more credit for saying the 19th interesting thing. You can just find a few interesting things to say and say them. What I'm looking for is, are you able to do what you did in the homework, but where you make up the questions, not me? So can you use the evaluation to see something interesting? I'm not trying to say, are you able to write a research paper that can get accepted to an international conference. I do hope some of you will write research papers that can get accepted to international conferences. If you want to use this as practice, that's perfectly fine. I'll be happy to give you feedback. But that's not the point. The point is to see if you can use the batch evaluation to draw a conclusion that is an answer to a question. Okay. And then it's polite at the end not to just end with a period, but to say something about, so here are a few things that people might want to try next, here's a limitation to what we did. Somebody ought to think about it to work or something like that. But for the purposes we're doing it here, that's really short. That's not the story. That's just some way of avoiding ending in the middle of the book. So the whole thing will probably turn out to be 6 pages, but that's because there's like a page full of graphs and stuff on it. Questions on that? So I'll write down what I just said. If you don't have any questions about that. Mike, you want to set up?
The user evaluation, that's just part of the final product report.
Right, so I originally thought of having the user evaluation be separate, but it is not for 2 reasons. One is that the batch evaluation is something that you can have a good batch evaluation or a not quite so good yet batch evaluation, but you can get a batch evaluation done and have some control over it. With the user evaluation, I mean, you know, users are squishy, they keep, you know, missing their appointments. If they give you a date by which the user evaluation had to be done, then you would potentially spend a whole bunch of time sweating the deadline. So I'm trying to get you not to worry about a deadline any earlier than it needs to be. I can't remove the deadline, you know, sooner or later, yeah. But I can push it back as far as possible. So I'm not suggesting that you wait until the last minute to do this. Just that until you need the user study results, there's no earlier deadline. Whereas with the batch evaluation, I really do want you to get something done. I don't care if you do a better batch evaluation or more analysis before your talk. I just want to get it behind you so you can think about the talk. And then I want to get the talk behind you so you can think about the paper. I want to get the paper behind you so you can think about the talk. So that was one reason. The second reason was that if you could use the user evaluation in the talk, you knew everything about the user evaluation I wanted you to know. Whereas with the batch evaluation, I really want you to think about what's the question, how are we measuring it, how do we interpret it. So I care much more about the rigor of the batch evaluation than I do about the rigor of the user study, because the user study has got so many more moving parts that getting a really rigorous user study is something that you normally do on the third try. And you're all doing the first try. But getting a rigorous batch evaluation is something you normally do on the first try, because other people have done it before you and you can follow the cookie cutter. So I'm actually more interested in the story of the batch evaluation. Okay?
Okay. So, Dr. Orser talks about miracles, I'm not going to talk about it again. My project was mainly starting to work on miracle. Miracle works for Hindi and for Cebuano, and I wanted to make it to work for Arabic. So, miracle, as you saw, is a very strong and efficient system that is written by one person and has no documentation whatsoever. So, this is Miracle. Not the same Dr. Ort showed you. Miracle, these boxes are classes, Java classes. So, the system has something about 100 classes in there. And my job was to go through them and try to figure out a way to make the thing work. So, we looked at Miracle. This was my project, finding and copying the source code and connecting the IR, connecting the collection, indexing that for Arabic collections and troubleshooting. So the thing is, Miracle works on inquiry, which doesn't really work on Windows, but inquiry is very similar, I guess, and that works on Windows, but inquiry visual, it's a whole very, very big mess. I had an issue with it connecting to the IR and connecting to the collection. So after 3 weeks, I found out that I was doing what we do in most of our classes, and that is working on the wrong problem. So this is what I had running, and this is what I should have run. So I decided that is a bad idea. Was it time wasted? No, because at the end of this, there will be documentation for Miracle that I will just read and continue to do this later. So that's good. Now this is my idea. I'm making a system that is an IR system and that works for English and Arabic. It's not bilingual. So am I making, is that enough just to make a system that is an IR system? I would say yes, but I would expect that it's not enough. So what I'm going to do is editor scope. So who's the user? Going back to users, who would be me? And I am making personal search engine. This is an engine that I'm making a system, not for research, but to be used. I'm making a system that I can use on my computer to search both English and Arabic documents. It will have all kinds of capabilities, like choosing the directory you want to search, show the results better than Microsoft Search shows them, and something that I will make use of when the
can you handle different documents for now? Word documents and PowerPoint?
No, not yet. Not yet. My system is built, what I have right now is very it's very simple. The thing is, what I'm going to work on more is the Arabic analyzer, because you can actually have the source code. I got some of this. I have the thread collection, the English thread collection, and the Arabic thread collection, so I'm going to index both, so I get a lot of them. And this is pretty much what it does right now. So I chose now because it's there in a lot of documents. Oh, well, I only indexed five. So I'm planning, this just shows you where the document is, like Microsoft Word. I'm planning, I know that Lucene can give you the segments and highlight the terms you have, so this is one of the things that my nurse will do. And if anyone has any suggestions, please send me.
Further questions? No? Great. Well. If as we get to the end of the projects you would like to come talk at any time, let me know. I'll be in town. The predicted time when everybody will show up is the day before the talks are due, which is a Sunday. I'll meet with you whenever.
I'm going to go to the next one.